Joint Ways and Means, General Government. We'll go ahead and get started. We're continuing the hearing. We've continued over on House Bill 5023, the Office of the Governor, continuing from yesterday. And we were on rest and return with Marty Sadoff. Marty, would you like to come forward? Kelly, did you have something you were going to present?
No, Mr. Chair. I presented the governor's budget on this agency.
Yeah, I think I'll have Brandon.
Okay.
All right.
And if it's all right to you, Mr. Chair, I'll have Fran sit here. I'll send back.
Okay, that'd be wonderful. Fran, welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say members of the committee, but okay. You had asked me to return today for a couple of... Sorry. Mr. Chair, my name is Marty Lynn Sathoff. I'm the Governor's General Counsel. I'm responsible for the arrest and return program in terms of managing it on his behalf.
Thank you, Marty.
Yesterday you had asked me to return to go through the overview of the presentation, so we'll try to limit our comments to very quickly running through the materials that we provided you yesterday that say presentation to the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, Arrest and Return. I believe that this committee has a good understanding of the extradition function of the state. But if I could direct you to page 3 of those materials, that it says program overview at the top.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out that the extradition program is a function of the governor's office. The Department of Administrative Services provides support. The person on my left is Fran Luchenko. She's the extradition officer, and in a minute I'll have her speak briefly about the services she offers. In general, I wanted this committee to understand that the arrest and return program is the program to fund and assist with the decisions regarding return of Class A and B felons. Our goals, on page 5 of the materials, you'll see our goals, but I'll just summarize those for you quickly. Our initial goal is cost-effective administration of policies that are set by the legislature, the governor, and in cooperation with all law enforcement officials in the state. A secondary goal, but certainly not less important, is that we want, through the program, to enhance the public's confidence in the public safety network in Oregon, and by cooperating with the law enforcement officers of the state in this program. Now, I'd like to briefly turn this over for just a few minutes to Fran Luchenko, our extradition officer, so she can tell you very quickly a little bit of what she does.
My name is Fran Luchenko, and I am the extradition officer, Interstate Agreement on Detainers Administrator for the State of Oregon. I have served as extradition officer since 1987, and in 2001 was appointed Agreement Administrator for the state. Essentially, I am the liaison between the governor's office and Oregon law enforcement agencies, other states, and the federal government in all Oregon rendition matters. The arrest and return program is structured to provide leadership to Oregon law enforcement agencies through analysis and evaluation of program requirements. The position works with the governor's office to develop, recommend, and implement statewide rendition policies and procedures. It serves also as a clearinghouse for all rendition information from which statistics are collected and compiled. In addition, this position alerts law enforcement personnel of the need for education as a result of new state and/or federal regulations. It provides and makes necessary available classes if required. By statute, the state of Oregon pays for the cost to extradite individuals. Therefore, reimbursement to counties for extradition costs are processed in this position. New laws, policies, and regulations can affect the arrest and return program. Whenever change is implemented that affects the service of the program, the extradition officer and the governor's office adapt or adjust the program to accommodate the new situation.
Fran, just hold it right there. Representative Johnson's recognized. Did you
hold sir. I was looking at my pen. Why it wasn't writing? I'm sorry.
When you hold your pen up like this, I beg your pardon, Fran. Please continue.
I apologize.
Let me just stop right there, Fran. You'd indicated that there's a reimbursement back to the counties for the arrest and return arrangement. To other states, there's not any reimbursement for the arrest and return?
Mr. Chair, no, there isn't. We only reimburse for individuals that the state of Oregon returns.
Okay.
So if we have somebody like in Wyoming we're bringing back, then we would pay for that cost if necessary. But if Wyoming had an extradition from Oregon, they would cover the costs.
Okay, and so we pay the state of Wyoming?
No.
We don't.
We pay the counties, the Oregon counties that perform the extradition to return the individual to Oregon.
Well, it's not your county because it's on the that end of the state or the state that is indicting the individual or the county that's indicting the individual. Then they send out from Marion County to pick the individual up in Wyoming.
If Marion County was the county that indicted,
right,
then they would dispatch. They have the choice, Mr. Chair, of dispatching their own officers or using the shuttle system or the marshals, whichever.
Shuttle system is multi-state, is it not, Fran?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. And how do we manage the cost of the shuttle if that person comes in through from Wyoming through Utah and Idaho? Who pays the cost of the shuttle up to the gates in Madyer County?
Mr. Chair, it's a reciprocity situation where if the individual is being returned from Wyoming, which is a shuttle state, they'll work with the various agencies involved in the shuttle to get the individual back, like to Malheur County, and then Malheur County will put him on an interstate transport system to be
what
brought
back. What we call a network or net?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. And the net, who pays for the net? Isn't that part of the van cost, the capitalized van cost I see in here? Isn't that the net?
Mr. Chair, that is true. We also do provide reimbursement to Multnomah County. Multnomah County is the workhorse for the shuttle system for the state of Oregon. They are paid a flat rate of mileage to and from, like, Umatilla County and up and down I-5. And that cost runs about $1,500 a month. And that's basically the only cost that Oregon has in subsidizing the shuttle outside of the capital outlay.
Again, that's the net.
That's correct.
Okay, fine. Please proceed, Mr. Jenko.
The governor's office continually strives to be more frugal with the arrest and return budget by seeking alternative and creative transport methods. Finally, coordination and communication between law enforcement organizations is handled by this program and is essential for good working relationships, not only with Oregon law enforcement entities, but other states and the federal government. And basically what I covered was the program services of the arrest and return slide, and then also factors affecting services. And now I'm going to turn this back to Marty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to point out to you on the organizational chart that the 0103 organizational chart versus the 0305, we are not seeking any change in position authority. We're maintaining the program as it has been. If you'll turn to the next slide, that at least on my handout is the ninth slide in your materials. I also wanted to provide you with some performance measures. And yesterday I was asked about the criteria that we use in terms of determining what arrests and returns do we engage in. I additionally today provided you with a memo from me to the district attorney, sheriffs, and correction personnel that will lay out that criteria for you. It is also included in that packet is the extradition policy that was put together during the 0103 biennium by my predecessor, Chip Lazenby. That's included as well. As you'll know, my letter really dealt just with the ending of the biennium and the need to modify the policy to address the budget issues towards the end. If you look for a moment at the performance measures, what we've provided you with, the number of extradition returns, I do note that there were additional questions yesterday asked about declines and some other comparative information. We're working on putting that together. We were not able to get that together yesterday for this morning. Please also note the percent of returns using the shuttle is 90% of our returns are done by that low-cost shuttle. Another element I wanted you to focus on is the cost regarding the policy question that was asked yesterday. Having two officers go on the transport as opposed to using the U.S. Marshal return. Two officers would be more money than the U.S. Marshal return, so we are using that process as our next lowest cost. Again, as I mentioned yesterday, the counties are able to decide in certain circumstances that only one officer would be needed for safety reasons. They would not feel the need for two. They would certainly choose that method over the U.S. Marshal at that point. If I could just direct your attention now to the budget request. As you can see, our request is in essence almost 25% lower than the last biennium. We have taken a long look at this. We would hope that we could maintain this level. We feel as though that if we were to dip further into this, that we are jeopardizing the program. In particular, we're jeopardizing the safety of officers who are engaged in this program.
What's the source of other funds, Marty?
I believe we get restitution as in other funds. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Restitution falls into other funds, and I might ask Fran if she knows if there are any other sources on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the restitution is, or the other funds, is made up of restitution that is ordered by courts when an individual is returned. The DAs have discretion as to seek the cost of extraditions to be included in the judgment and to be awarded to the state of Oregon, and those funds that come in go to the other fund.
Do the DAs regularly request that, Fran?
Mr. Chair, they have to take it on a case-by-case basis, and they do their best. A lot of the individuals we're bringing back are indigent defense individuals, which the court would deny extradition costs on that.
Okay.
So they do try.
All right. Further questions of Marty or of Fran? Marty?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just one other point I would like to make. And if you'll take a look at our last slide, I did want to point out to you that a portion of this increase, and actually, pardon me, it's not even an increase, it's a shift from the general fund of about $16,000. Is due to the reclassification of Ms. Lushenko as an extradition officer. As I pointed out yesterday, she not only is managing the arrest and return at the logistic level, she's also taken on the interstate agreement on detainers. And given all of that, we felt that a shift from the general fund of the $16,000 over the biennium, the 2 years, was important. In addition, I wanted to point out that a number of the shifts have to do with more accurately itemizing how we're spending the money. So it includes a shift in limitation regarding about $163,000, and that is to identify that much of that money is used for professional services, the Attorney General, and rent overhead.
And the rent overhead is for the total biennium, the $7,188.
Yes.
Okay. Further questions of either Fran or Marty? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, before you're excused, I wanted to make sure that there was a number of questions asking for information yesterday.
Yesterday, regarding the arrest and return, we have that before us.
And I wanted to verify the list that I have to make sure that I can get the information needed. I think Senator Winters mentioned the number of extraditions for the last biennium coming and going, the number of A and B felons included in that, the location that we're returning the individuals from, and then other states' budgets and how they handle extraditions, and also the salaries awarded to those extradition officers. Is that correct?
My recollection, yeah, to get as much information, comparative information as we could.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Tell us, that wraps up the governor's office at this point.
Yes, sir.
They've returned and given a rest in the report.
Yeah.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5023, Office of the Governor. And we are awaiting other information from the arrest and return. I think that was the last of the information that we were after on that budget.
That's correct.
Okay. We will then open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5535, the Oregon Public Broadcasting. And Maynard, welcome. And Tom, please. Dallas, would you like to give us the Legislative Fiscal Office's presentation, please?
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have our write-up of the governor's balanced budget, the about $3.4 million of, I consider its grant to public broadcasting to help support operations, represents about 10% or so of the operating budget. I should point out, in the prior biennium, there was a additional $7 million of other funds, which were really, really lottery bond monies that were used for infrastructure. This biennium, not in the OPB budget, but in the Department of Administrative Services, there's about $1.6 million of lottery fund debt service to pay those. So we'll see that when we finalize the Department of Administrative Services budget. Other than that, we don't have much, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. Tom, are you going to start off this morning?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here, members of the committee. I'm Tom Bruguer, and I'm the incoming chair of the Public Broadcasting Board of Directors, and I'm pleased to be here this morning with Mayor Norum, who's our executive director. And I also wanted to just introduce a couple of our audience members, our supporters and volunteers who have come down to join us. Alex Graham from Scappoose, just wave your hand if you would. Maggie O'Brien from West Lynn, just wave your hand if you would. I think it's important to note that Oregon Public Broadcasting each week has about 1 million viewers for our television programs, and more than 300,000 people they listen to Oregon Public Broadcasting Radio. So we are truly a statewide resource, and we believe an important resource. There's just three things that I'd like to highlight before I turn it over to Maynard to talk in a little more detail about Oregon Public Broadcasting and the needs of Oregon Public Broadcasting and the value of the resource to our state that Oregon Public Broadcasting brings. It really is more than just a set of audience numbers. It's a service that reaches people throughout our state, particularly in the rural parts of our state, and is one of the best resources, in some cases the only resources, that we have that really brings people together throughout our state. The three things I'd like to highlight are, first of all, the emergency alert system for the state of Oregon, which Oregon Public Broadcasting provides. It's approved by the Federal Communications Commission as the state's central emergency alert system center, and we calculate that the cost for Oregon Public Broadcasting to provide that service is about $5 million for the biennium, including labor, infrastructure, et cetera. The second, and equally as important, is the Amber Alert System for the state of Oregon, which Oregon Public Broadcasting provides. As you may know, these alerts are delivered throughout the state, and in fact, recently, on a couple of occasions, we've had successful Amber Alerts that have resulted in returns of the children involved. And thirdly, and equally as important again, are the educational services that Oregon Public Broadcasting provides. So I'm also the incoming chair of the Weston Wilsonville School District. And we use a number of the resources that Oregon Public Broadcasting provides in our school district to be able to offer programming and help offset some of the other cuts that we have in the district as well. We have our services reaching more than 18,000 educators in the state, about 276,000 students through the classroom programs that we have, and it's a very valuable resource both to our teachers, to our students, and for enhancing the quality of education that we have. Now, we understand very clearly the very difficult budget decisions that you all have to make as we go into this next biennium. I understand it because I work daily with our school district budget, and we are dealing, as we speak, with laying off teachers. We understand it because of the health and human services cuts and the other things that you deal with. However, we also hope that you'll be able to work out a place in the budget for the important things that Oregon Public Broadcasting provides to the state, the emergency alert system, the Amber alert system, the educational services that that we provide, because we think those are things that the state would be very much worse off without having and without supporting. With that, what I would like to do is turn it over, Mr. Chair, to Maynard Orm to talk a little bit about some of the details of Oregon Public Broadcasting and our budget, and we'd be happy to take any questions at any point in time.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to talk to you today. For the record, my name is Maynard Orm, and I'm President and CEO of Oregon Public Broadcasting. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about Senate Bill 5535 and our request for $3.4 million for OPB for the 2003-2005 biennium. We have had a partnership with the state of Oregon since 1922. In 1980, we separated from the Department of Higher Education and became our own state agency, and were run by a commission, and then in 1993 became a private nonprofit organization. Despite the fact that we are no longer a state agency, we still provide many statewide connections and services to Oregonian, and the costs of these providing these services, especially the emergency alert and Amber alert system, are far more than the revenue received through state funds. we have another relationship with the state in that the governor of Oregon appoints 20% of our board. Our basic mission is to provide lifelong learning opportunities that inform, educate, and enrich people through the delivery and development of exemplary programs and services. And I just want to emphasize one of our goals, which is to increase OPB's presence as an integral institution within local, state, and regional communities through programming and the emergency alert and Amber Alert systems, outreach, education-related services, and relationship building. If I could categorize what we do, we provide information, education, safety, and quality programs for the Oregonians and Southwest Washingtonians. We use funds from the state of Oregon for our emergency alert system, which is a crucial aspect of our network. As you've heard from Mr. Berger, we cover approximately 90% of Oregonians, and with our partnership with KSYS, basically cover the whole state. With this strong network, this is really the key to providing an emergency alert and Amber Alert system throughout the state of Oregon. Oregon Public Broadcasting is the backbone for that service, and our budget of $3.4 million does not adequately cover all the costs to maintain that system. I want to point out to you a chart which you have in your materials that reflects the decrease in OPB revenue from the state in the past 10 years. In 1991-93, we were funded in the operational side to the tune of about $6 million for the biennium, and that dropped almost $1 million a year over each biennium to a point where last biennium it was $2 million, and as you know, the recommendations are this biennium are for no funding, which we hope you would reconsider. One of the key programs and services that we offer is education. I want to talk about that for just a moment, but before I begin that, I'd like to introduce Doug Costi, the Director of Technology for the Oregon Department of Education, who has a few words that he'd like to say on behalf of Oregon Public Broadcasting. If you possible.
Yeah. Chair Butler, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to take a few minutes to talk about the Oregon Public Broadcasting and the connection to the Oregon Department of Education. My name is Doug Costi. I'm Director of Technology, Oregon Department of Education. The department has been engaged in the development of distance and education technology infrastructure in partnership with school and education service districts for many years. The future of access to educational opportunities can be summarized by the following: any place, any time, any path, any pace. In order to actualize this vision, broad investments and partnerships are not only important but critical. OPB has begun development of a warehouse of outstanding learning resources, accessible to teachers in Oregon for integration into their daily lessons. As future generations of young Oregonians come to the classroom, we must become more sophisticated in our ability to use a variety of tools in our instructional programs. Your investment in OPB is a mutual investment in Oregon schools. We're excited to work on an evolving partnership with OPB to create an e-learning environment that serves all students, rural and urban, giving them access to learning regardless of geography. The Department of Education supports the budget of OPB and encourages you to support it as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you, Doug. I really appreciate that. Just to review, last year, Oregon's Teacher Resource Services provided curriculum materials to more than 18,000 educators and 276,000 students. And given the funds that the state puts in, I would say that's a heck of a leveraged opportunity for the state for education and instruction. Our Ready to Learn service provides hands-on opportunities for parents, teachers, and child care providers who work with preschool children. And we think that's a very important function. We provided over 56 workshops, reaching 2,400 children and 890 parents and caregivers last year. We also provide another very important service called Golden Hours, which frankly, is a cost center. It operates with two full-time staff and a volunteer staff of about 40 people. And we're on the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to provide a service for the blind, people that are really locked into their home, and impaired people. It is just, if you've never seen that service, I think we would invite you in to show you what we do there to help people who don't have the same advantages that we do. Something else I want to point out, which is not necessarily related to this hearing, but that Oregon Public Broadcasting is the fourth largest provider of primetime programs for PBS. We have a wonderful production staff. We raise almost $9 million a year to fund that service, which is completely separate from our broadcast services, but has established Oregon Public Broadcast as a premier provider of information for people throughout the United States as well as Oregonians. And we really believe that's one of our survival strategies. And we've, of course, received many awards for that. I would say, too, that in our budget request to you, that without those funds, we would have to pare back significantly in areas that I think could be hurtful to the state in terms of providing emergency alert, regular emergency alert, and Amber Alert systems. I might also say that during the past biennium, that system has been used almost 25 times to alert people to crisis, to test the system, and those have all been initiated by the state. They run over our radio and television services and are really a lifeline, especially in the rural areas. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to just end my remarks and open it up for questions, as I know you probably have many, and I think that probably would be the most helpful thing to do now.
Thank you very much. President Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Tom Maynard. Maynard, as you know, and I don't know whether some of the members of the committee know, I had the privilege of serving on the OPB board for a long time. And I think you'll recall back in 1993, when I was an OPB board member, I came down here with an OPB team to ask the legislature to let OPB change its status from a state agency that at that time the station found burdensome to a not-for-profit. I listened to my own testimony at the committee promising that OPB wouldn't come back to the legislature for funding. It's 10 years later, and OPB is back, asking for and receiving $7 million in other funds last biennium, and in this hearing asking for $3 million in general fund. Why in the last decade, knowing the promises that were made, didn't OPB structure a departure from state aid, having promised in 1993 that they would not seek additional general fund?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, at that point in time, there was an Oregon law that said that the state recognizes a continuing obligation to contribute to the support of the not-for-profit organization known as Oregon Public Broadcasting, and that it recognizes a continued financial partnership with the OPB and the citizens of Oregon, and that was essential to preserve the services. So that certainly, especially for the disabled at that point in time, so that certainly was a piece of the law. While we indicated that we were going to seek less support, which you can see from the results of the budget cuts that we have done that, at this point in time, it would be very difficult to separate totally from the state in terms of financial support. And the reason I say that is that OPB is the most aggressive state network in seeking membership, corporate, and foundation funds of any state network in America. And we are far ahead of any other state. So in that regard, we have really matured our membership service. And at this point, the cost of developing new members is really more than the member would give to OPB. So we are at that cut point where, frankly, on these specific services that we're asking for support for, such as EAS and Amber Alert, that we will simply not be able to raise that additional funding from members as much as we would like to think we could.
Mr. Chair, but at the last time, Maynard, when state support was cut in, as the discussion occurred, and you were on the TV with you had the benefit of the bully pulpit, and you were on the TV and the radio with a very aggressive fundraising campaign. And in an emergency, you were able, as I recall, to raise $1 million.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's true. We did raise $1 million, but we needed $1.5 million. So we're still utilizing our own reserves in some cases. And as you may recall, in June, we cut 19 people and 6 other unfilled positions to balance our budget for the coming year. And without these funds, we will have to go through a similar process. So we're conscious of our need to both balance our budget, reduce staff and services as necessary, but to provide services that we think are necessary for the state.
Continue to follow up.
Just one more follow-up minute, but in that same period of time, haven't you acquired property around the station and made additional capital investment?
Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, yes, we have, and that was a long-term effort of going over 10 years. And when that property became available, since we actually we have a letter from Rob Ball, a previous chair of the board, who worked with us on a committee to look at whether OPB should move from its current site or stay there, and based on the best realty knowledge of Portland, it was decided that it would be more fiscally responsible to stay in that location than move. So that's why we bought that property next door to us, and I think it was a really good investment. It does cost us a little every year, but we do rent that property out, so it is a long-term investment, which I'm very pleased with, and I think it was, frankly, a very important investment for OPB.
What was the total price, Mayor?
$3.5 million we paid for that building. Our current building cost us more than $5 million, and we used that, our current building, which was paid off, to borrow from U.S. Bank at a very, very reasonable loan rate. And we are currently renting it out, and we will be putting our own staff in there in the near-term future.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Does the $3 million contemplate the cleanup?
The cleanup, Chairman Butler, Representative Johnson, the cleanup has been signed off by the state of Oregon, but we are monitoring that. We had set aside, I believe it was $25,000, of which we have not spent at all, and we are continuing to monitor that service. And frankly, we would probably build, if we were to take that building down and put a new building in, which we don't contemplate near term, we would probably put parking on the bottom so that there would be no direct office space. But we're very conscious of that and would not have bought the building if it was not signed off by the state of Oregon, Department of Environmental Quality.
So the cleanup's all done?
Well, we're still monitoring it, but it's basically fine.
What's the nature of the contamination?
Mr. Chair, the contamination was there was a cleaning facility, a paint factory there, and there were some vats there that had lead in them, which have since been removed.
I see. So potential groundwater or ground soil contamination.
Right. Mr. Chairman, the building that we're currently in was a rubber factory, which had actually even more contaminants, and I think we're just fine. I don't see a major problem.
That's where they used to print my checks.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I just add on Representative Johnson's question? I was not on the board back in 1993, 1994, when you were going through the process, but the history of it, as I'm aware, is Oregon Public Broadcasting used to get about 50 or 60% of its budget from the state of Oregon, and used to, of course, be a state agency. Today, Oregon Public Broadcasting has worked that number down to where we get roughly about 8% of our budget in operating funds comes from the state. So we've reduced that number from 50, 60% over that, 10-year period of time, 8-year period of time, down to about 8%. That 8%, that $3.5 million that is in the request now, would go basically covering the payment for services that are provided to the state in the form of the emergency alert system and the Amber Alert system. While I do think that moving to a nonprofit has been a good thing for the state and a good thing for Oregon Public Broadcasting, I also believe that for the services that Oregon Public Broadcasting is providing to the state, that there is an amount of money that is appropriate to pay to offset the cost of those services that we are providing.
And the total budget must be something in the vicinity of about $43 million if we're looking at 8%.
Mr. Chairman, our current broadcast operating budget is about $16.5 million.
Per year.
Per year. Yeah, that would be 32 plus.
Okay.
Then our national international production funds that we develop is about 9 million a year, so at 18 million over the biennium. And so if you add in our basically $25 million a year budget, the state funds this year were about 3% of our operating budget, which, of course, because we lost the $1.2 million in rescission. But if it's back in and you add in all the money, it's probably 6 or 7% of our budget.
I see. Okay. Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, in my particular case, believing that state support should continue, I do, though, have a question about the calculations in terms of the emergency alert and AMBER.
Right.
Are those truly the marginal costs of providing that,
or are they the costs if you looked at it sort of in the other direction?
Chairman, I mean, if you weren't providing it,
right,
could you reduce your budget by that amount?
Chairman Butler, Senator Devlin, that's a good question. Our total capital investment at OPB is about $34 million that is actually the capital equipment cost. We have depreciated that down to about $20 million at this point. We have a partnership with Channel 8 to run our Skyline facility, which is about a $5 million cost, plus our remaining $14 million costs is about $20 million. Of that, about $7 million is our technical equipment cost that would affect the distribution, of which about a little over $5 million is the EAS portion. And if you depreciate that out over 7.5 years, that's a cost of about $750,000 a year just in depreciation. And then the other costs would be maintenance of that distribution system, both the microwave, the translators, and all the transmitters, which would be a portion of the cost that we would need to operate 24/7. We're not required to operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but we do that for that service, and obviously it helps us a little bit. But frankly, our audiences from like 1 in the morning to 5 in the morning are pretty puny. So we would certainly look to many ways to solve this problem if we didn't get funding. I'm not saying we would do that, but we would certainly look at many options to reduce that, one of which would be to, while the equipment, the analog equipment is still there, it would affect what we would buy in terms of digital translators and the way in which we might distribute that signal over the future, which might cut out some areas where our membership isn't particularly high, just because we'd be happy to operate on a cost-center basis, on a profit-center basis.
Manager, my recollection was that the $7 million of capitalized equipment last session was for the digital equipment. Isn't that correct?
Yes, Senator, Chairman Butler, yes, that's correct. That $7 million was not specifically set aside, as I recall, for distribution, but was generally was a, represents about a third of the costs of converting to digital to a digital broadcast service. So that's a piece of it, but it doesn't include the depreciation and what we would have to do to replace that equipment in out years.
So. But I guess as I look at your milestones accomplished, the first digital equipment was actually online in 1997, so we were funding the tail end of it.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. And again, for the record, Dallas, what's our debt service on that $7 million capital outlay?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, $1.6 million for this 0305 biennium.
Okay.
You'll see it in the Department of Administrative Services budget under special payments.
So the $1.6 million is the current biennial service of that $7 million,
yes,
to bring them up to the full digital capacity. And are you running any analog at this point?
Mr. Chairman, we will run analog. The FCC is requiring shutdown of the analog as of December 2006, but it will never happen. We will be running analog, my guess is, until 2016. So we currently will be running two services, and the cost of running the digital service is much higher than the analog because these are in higher transmitter ranges, which need more energy to get out to the same coverage area. So we're going to be there for a long time. People are just not buying. They're starting to buy sets more, but people are basically getting the receivers on top of their sets and converting their analog sets. So we probably will have that service for at least another 10 to 12 years.
I'd like to make certain that the record is clear relative to the emergency alert service and the AMBER alert service, or the AMBER alert system. and this budget request. Can you bring us in some definitive terms what the effect of the state's failure to meet a $3.4 million budget request would be to the emergency alert system service and the Amber Alert system?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. Actually, there would be no immediate effect. I mean, we're not going to shut down anything. But over time, and probably starting in July of 2003, we would have to lay off some engineers. I have no doubt of that. And that would reduce our response time on those translators in rural areas from hours to probably days or weeks, especially where there's no audience, I mean, there's no membership. The DTV site costs and maintenance are severe in terms of above and beyond the capital just to maintain those sites. So we're going to have to look seriously at whether we actually put in DTV translators in some of those areas. As I mentioned before, we would have to look at decreasing our on-air hours and, again, other things that we would do. We wouldn't want to totally take all the money here. We want to look at OPB across the board and look at other services that we might need to reduce above and beyond this to help us provide a minimal service that we could. But it will be very hard to do, I can assure you.
But the first hours of service that could potentially be lost would be perhaps between 1 and 5?
Possibly, yes. We'll look at that and see what kind of effect it has on us. But again, it's all about saving resources.
And earlier you mentioned there's been a staff reduction of, I think, 16 people.
19 people and 6 empty positions. And that was in June of 2003.
Total staff size now?
It's 140.
After this 19 reduction from the 16.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was about 160 plus before that. We really haven't added back any significant staff.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. The first one is, it would be very helpful, and perhaps it's in this material that was just passed out, and I haven't had a chance to take a look at it, but a budget?
Sure. For the total of the year we're in?
Yeah, that would be great.
You bet. We'll provide one.
And secondly, to come back to the Amber Alert, I'm getting the impression from the testimony that you're providing that OPB is the sole provider of Amber Alert services.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we are the network hub for the Amber Alert services, and it's distributed through OPB to commercial radio and television stations around the state. That's how we create that sort of network.
Are we damaging the hub?
Not initially, we wouldn't, but we will still provide that service. But over time, we would make decisions that might not include areas in rural Oregon.
President Johnson, please follow up.
Thank you. If, Maynard, there's the potential of damage to the hub, what is the likelihood that the hub could be moved to Channel 6 or to...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it could be, but they don't have the network infrastructure that we have, combining Oregon Public Broadcasting and KSYS. We have 5 television, 5 radio transmitters, and over 60 translators scattered around the state. No other broadcast entity has that. And then you add KSYS's network in there, it just covers the whole state pretty well.
I guess the feeling that I'm getting from the testimony is, and correct me because this is going to sound a little harsh, if you don't give us the $3 million, we hurt the Amber Alert system. I'm asking how else you could prioritize within your budget if the provision of the Amber Alert is so essential to Oregonians. What other economies you could find in your budget to keep that service available to Oregonians. I know, for example, OPB, even during the time that I was on the board, had undertaken a very aggressive production schedule that had people living in New York and traveling all over the world to do very valuable pieces. But my question is that if, as you describe it, the Amber Alert is essential to the health and well-being of Oregonians, and we have had this partnership since 1922, why would OPB put something that's essential to the health and well-being of Oregonians at risk without looking to cut within their budget at other places that held Amber Alert harmless,
right,
and perhaps looked at decreases in your national or international production schedule?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the national production funds are separate and distinct from the operating budget. We raise those funds from our partners in America and around the world to produce those programs. So reducing those budgets would have no impact on this budget because those monies are raised for specific programs. So we couldn't use those monies in any other way.
But you commit monies, OPB monies.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, actually OPB does not really commit money to those productions. We raise it. We use other people's money to do that.
You have staff costs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, those costs are built into the cost of operating that particular aspect of our business.
But it is standalone budget.
Yes, and for instance, last year we netted about $1 million in net income from those services, which was then put back into the budget. Well,
then follow up, Mr. Chair. Then instead of having me try to elicit it out of you, you suggest to me what other areas savings might be realized in your budget to preserve Amber Alert, because you characterize that as essential to the well-being of Oregonians.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, as I mentioned before, we would not take all the funds out of this distribution system. We would spread it around the organization, and one of the things we'd have to do would be to look at what I consider to be other essential services, such as some of our locally produced programs and services, where we do not receive full payment for those services. We have to look at cost centers and say, okay, what can we do here to provide the essential services to keep OPB alive? We're not in the mood to do away with EAS or Amber Alert. What we're trying to say is that we'll do our best to maintain that system, but over time, as we make decisions about our statewide infrastructure for distribution, we would have to look at areas where there are simply derived costs with no revenue and ask ourselves, are those things that we can afford to do in the future?
Maynard, with regard to the budget that Representative Johnson has asked for, you have a breakout of the emergency alert service or system service and the Amber Alert service. Are those separately categorized in your budget?
Mr. Chairman, we have a breakout of the budget which shows elements of our distribution system. And the Amber and Emergency Alert system are nested within the distribution of the technical equipment. So in that extent,
it
would be hard to break it out specifically because there are so many overlaid services there.
Mr. Chair, if I could just...
Tom, go ahead.
Add to Maynard's point, if we were not to get any money from the state, the board, the development team would do everything that we can to go out and raise money to offset those cuts and those costs. The difficulty, though, is as we look at the budget and as we look at the essential services and as we look at the mission of Oregon Public Broadcasting, it's a little difficult for us to understand why we would be asked to go ahead and provide an essential state service like emergency alert system and the Amber Alert system, but not have the state give us any money to do that. The logic to us doesn't make too much sense. You know, we would certainly not want to turn that off, and we would do everything we can to keep that going. We'd have to go out and raise money from our constituents, from our community, from foundations and things like that to do that.
Is that and you folks are professional fundraisers in that regard, and I don't know, we do have an additional $1.6 million of debt service that we're meeting now as a result of the advance of the $7 million, which I thought was for the final conversion, and I thought we'd paid, as a percentage, a larger share of the final conversion to digital in the $7 million. Originally, I think we talked about more than $7 million originally, didn't we, last session?
Mr. Chairman, the total package was $8 million, of which $1 million went to KSYS.
Okay.
So that may be what you're thinking about.
Okay, that's probably it. But is there an opportunity to go back to the public viewers and and have them participate, or is it so program driven that that wouldn't be a resource to the station?
Mr. Chairman, it is very program driven. It doesn't mean that we can't use that in our request for funds as Connecting Oregon, and we would certainly consider doing that.
I've got, I'll bet 8 out of 10 of my email that I receive from constituents and non-constituents alike tell me that they would be happy to have their taxes raised if the essential services mm-hmm. could be provided. Mm-hmm. And here is a way for them not to have an increase in tax, but to have a 501c3 write-off, a charitable write-off, and still be able to get the best of both worlds with so very little administrative costs.
Mr. Chairman, you make a good point. If there were some way to provide that write-off for people who would give funds for that purpose, we would certainly love to consider some sort of legislation that would provide that.
Don't we have a dovetail, and I realize that we had set up the credit last time
right.
for the monies cultural. To go to the Cultural Trust, and really, have you attempted in any way to try and dovetail that credit? Because the half of it, the first half of the deduction before a taxpayer would receive the tax credit, is to include good charitable organizations
yeah.
okay. in that blend, such as OPB. Have you tried to work that kind of a cooperative partnership with those folks?
Mr. Chairman, the cooperative partnership was really worked with the Oregon Cultural Trust. We were very much a part of that in terms of developing that. So we looked at that as an umbrella. If you are interested in looking at some other aspect here, we would certainly love to look at that. I think that's a good idea.
I think we really need to go ahead and come back and address that, because I felt after we heard the testimony relative to the Cultural Trust that in that process we had, in an attempt to try and introduce culture back into Oregon, I continue to recall the words of Senator Curioli in that regard. He said he once had a brush with culture, but fortunately was thrown free. And as we attempted to try and gather those resources together for culture in Oregon, I felt like we really bent over a long, long ways. And perhaps I think it was sold to many of us that Oregon Historical Society and the Oregon Public Broadcasting and others would be the obvious beneficiaries of this in order to get that second half of a charitable contribution made to the Cultural Trust. And I'm hopeful that there is some nexus. Have you felt some nexus in the giving program?
Mr. Chairman, I and many in this room gave the maximum amount we could to the Cultural Trust to make that happen. The answer to your question is no, we've not felt anything from that. And I gather that you're considering how you might use those funds in another way.
Well, I'm asking there is, shouldn't we make the same opportunities available to the Oregon Public Broadcasting that we have made, and the Oregon Historical and other good organizations and associations of this nature that we have made available to the Oregon Historical Trust?
Mr. Chairman, that would be wonderful. We were trying to work as a team to get the Oregon Cultural Trust established. But if there are other ways to set aside funds for, like, these emergency alert services and systems, we would love to consider that.
Well,
that would be terrific.
Again, I think the anticipation was that by offering the credit through the Cultural Trust, what we were doing was we were anticipating, that by large measure we would be enhancing the opportunities to contribute to the Oregon Public Broadcasting. And I don't know that the second part of that actually ever came to fruition.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we've received no funds at this point from that, and frankly don't anticipate receiving large funds from that. It was really set up to fund a lot of the smaller organizations. Even though we could receive a part of it, it would in no way come close to the direct funding that we receive from the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I could just add on the fundraising aspect of it. As Maynard said earlier, with the state shortfall over this last year, we've had to go off and try to raise an additional about $1.2 million, I think it is.
It's actually about 1.5 when you add in the cost of fundraising, because we're doing lots of letters.
Of which we've been able to do about $1 million. Mm-hmm. The difficulty that we find ourselves in is similar to the difficulty you all find yourselves in. One of our large contributors, the corporate sector in the state, has had its difficulties, and we've seen our corporate giving drop off dramatically. We've been pleased with the level of individual contributions that we've been able to get, but we haven't been able to make up those shortfalls. So we look at shortfalls really on a couple of axes there, on our corporate giving as well as on our state funding. So if we could go out and raise the money for example, the emergency alert system easily from our constituents, we'd do anything we could to do that. But we face the same difficulties that you all are facing in the state.
I need to have a forward on my email of everyone that wants to be taxed more, and I can just send it out to you folks. Senator,
I have a question, because I noted that under the emergency system that there were no Homeland Security dollars that you received. Did you receive any funds when, I believe it was it last and one of the e-boards that we received approval from some federal dollars that had to do with planning for Homeland Security that went to the governor's office?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, no, we did not. We are working with our national representative organization and Tom Ridge's new cabinet position to develop funds for Homeland Security for public broadcasting, but I doubt that there will be funds forthcoming in the next year or two. And it's my understanding also that the state of Oregon will not, at this point anyway, receive Homeland Security funds, although I'm not an expert on that.
We did receive some first responder dollars.
Right.
Which dealt with trying to plan systems and to look at who would be the first response. And that's why I wondered if you had received or were involved in the utilization of planning of those
Senator
dollars.
Winters, we would enjoy being a part of that process if you would like us to be. But we have not been at this point.
It appears that there's an opportunity to discuss, and not necessarily for this particular session, or the time which we have allotted to us in this particular session, but it appears that we do have an opportunity to discuss the potential of the tax credits. This is an area that I have been very interested in the past with regard to the Historical Society as well as public broadcasting. I wish we could have gotten in front of this again, I think it was anticipated that the Cultural Trust would generate rather substantial and enhanced amounts of giving to the Cultural Trust or to the Oregon Public Broadcasting and Historical. And we'll be hearing this Historical Society's budget tomorrow, and I'm anxious about the proposed lack of funding that we have there. So I'd like to see members of the Ways and Means process get in front of this and start now working towards some kind of blend. And obviously with the revenue, the legislative revenue, as well as legislative fiscal. But this is, by and large, a revenue issue as we go in and you've got the one of many, quote-unquote, tax expenditures now that we look at when we offer that credit, whether it's the credit for the Oregon Cultural Trust or whether it's credit for political tax credits at that point. But those are the kinds of things that we need to anticipate.
Mr. Chairman, I would so enjoy the opportunity to explore that. I think that's a great idea, and we'd love to do that.
Mayor, perhaps after we gavel closed, you and Tom and I can maybe just take just a moment and discuss the potential of maybe developing. And I'm going to I need either a member of the Senate or a member of the House that'll join with me. Seeing all the House members here on one side and seeing Senator Devlin, would you like to join with me as we do that, as we just do a little bit of exploring there? Would that be possible?
That would be fine, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Why don't we, and you're in session early again today, I assume, on the Senate side. Further questions of Mr. Breguere or Mayor Norm? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
We appreciate it, too.
And let's go ahead and then close the public hearing. And I didn't have anyone sign up for on the list for the public hearing on. Is there anyone here that wanted to testify on behalf of this budget that didn't get signed up by any chance?
And Mr. Chair, could I also just point out that one of our other board members, former legislator Tony Van Vliet, is with us today in the audience.
You give Tony an opportunity to say something positive on behalf of OPB, I'll let you do so.
And I would love to take my chair.
Come on,
Tony,
do that, Tony.
We'd
be pleased to have you come forward. Tony, we have a piggy bank here. That's actually the American Cancer Society. For any acronyms that you'd like to use, like OPB or anything like that.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Having sat on that side for 17 years, I know what you're going through. And I'd like to say a few things, more from a philosophical standpoint, and that is that going back into the recession of the 80s, we felt very strongly at that time that there were certain kinds of public services that we should provide, that everybody should be involved in the state, and Oregon Public Broadcasting was one, and so was the Oregon Historical Society, and those budgets were not touched to any great extent during that recessionary time. However, we did drift into a situation where we started to look at user fees, and user fees became very popular, as well as tax credits and tax write-offs as far as checking off your income tax. All of those seemed to run the gamut of being very popular for a short period of time and then drift into sort of oblivion. And I'm not sure that in certain kinds of state services that where everybody has really got an obligation that we should look at those kind of approaches. You're looking right now at the opportunity of possibly looking at tax exemptions that have gone pretty astronomical if you look at the budget book and tax credits that have been given over a long history. And I caution that kind of an approach often because tax credits basically look good for a while, but they take the emphasis off of what we really should be doing as legislators, and that's looking for long-range solutions that will be long-lasting and involve the people of the state of Oregon in those things and those services which are really needed. And I have always looked at Oregon Public Broadcasting as being one of those, even though it is now a quasi, what I call a quasi-public and private agency. It has got those things going out there. Having been on the Environmental Quality Commission, I can tell you, as we start burning the poison gases in Hermiston, if anything goes wrong, a statewide alert system is going to be very necessary in the whole process. And as you look today in the, there has been discovered a white powder of some kind up in the Washington area, and it looks to me like we're in for a long flush of those kinds of things that are going to occur in this country, which make the emergency system even more essential, as well as the Amber Alert. While we could look at tax deductions as a possibility, we seem to, as we look at fundraising in OPB, you are always looking at a very hardcore that are very supportive. But there's a lot of the public that can't afford often to contribute to OPB that are receiving the services out there that really become a portion of the statewide obligation, I feel, that we should be doing as state legislators and looking at that as a service. Now, I understand your comments about the fact that it was said one time you're going to stand in your own two legs, but we know that that often doesn't happen in state agencies. As they say that, they come back and are in trouble because they can't quite do it quite that way, or the economics of the situation don't occur as we thought they would do. And for a while in the 1990s, we thought everything was going to go up, but a lot of us cautioned the fact that what goes up comes down, and always be ready for the unexpected in the legislative process. So I encourage you to look at really the statewide obligation of what we ought to be doing to fix this whole system up. And we keep putting these little rowboats out in rough seas, and some of them are getting swamped. And when you lose that service, you will have a tough time recouping some of those essential services in the state.
Thank you. Questions for former Representative Leap, Senator Devlin?
Thank you. Mr. Van Vliet, I actually agree with your sentiments, and although I do believe that most of these budgets that we will have to reduce them further than what the governor's proposal is, given what our what our actual revenue picture is. But when I look at OPB's budget request, I look at it as serving, you know, literally a large portion of the Oregon populace, and it's about the equivalent of $1 per person per biennium, or 50 cents annually. I think that we'll probably have to reduce it. I would hope that we would still fund, provide some funding to OPB.
Thank you. Richard Johnson.
Thank you. I agree with much of what you said, too. Given your long experience, and I'm just starting my second session, both sessions in times of horrific cuts, I'm particularly mindful of the burden that Senator Winters has with shepherding through a DHS budget. We have heard over five special sessions, and the sixth special session, the beginning of this regular session, terrible stories of people coming in and waiting patiently 6 hours to testify, to come and tell a legislative panel that they have only 22 days worth of life-sustaining medicine. Help me, if you were sitting where we are in not bountiful times, balance EB on the one hand that has the capacity to go out and raise $1 million over a weekend, and a painter from Eugene who is a working stiff his whole life and as a result of being a painter has pulmonary problems and has been part of a medically needy program that we are cutting. And he comes and says to a legislative panel, I have 22 days worth of pills left. Help me with your experience in this building and your wisdom. Know, how do you balance those two?
Well, for one thing is that you can't always go out and raise that million for a statewide obligation. The second is having sat most of my time on the Human Resource Committee, I know exactly what you're up against. In 1980, when we were given the task of cutting $600+ million out of a $2.3 billion budget, we did just what the legislatures always do, and they go in and they look at service and supplies, vacant positions, where the fat is, reducing CPIs and some of the things, and we did those, but we could only find $300 million. We listened to everybody who came in on those other cases, and we said we can't go any further. The governor said we couldn't go any further, and we essentially put in a surtax, and we voted it out. And today, if I had to assess a lot of the opinion around the state, I think you're going to find more people who might buy a short-term cure like that as long as they knew you were going to come in with a long-time fix. And I haven't seen any movement so far on a long-time fix. There are apparently people in the building working on that, and I think that's going to be very essential. But you're going to need a short-time fix because by the time you get the long-time one, it takes some time, one, to get it passed. Second is to put it into effect. We saw that with the sales tax that we wrote way back. It would take you a good year to get that cranked up and going. So you need that short-time fix right now to get you through. And I think the public would buy that if they knew you were on the road to a long-time fix.
I thank you very much, Tony, and I think I need to recognize that Representative Patridge is worth a group right now today working on both the short-term and the long-term fixes, trying to anticipate, you know, what would be the long-term needs, what's the current short-term fix to get us through, particularly in light of the 10-point spread on the failure of Measure 28 this past November, or this past...
That's encouraging. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
Mr. Senator? Chair, since my committee comes up quite a bit, and since as the subcommittee chair who has the responsibility for that budget, and I respect your comments, Senator Van Fleet, but this budget this time, and I was back, you know, in some of those years, is probably a lot more complicated than it was when you were here in 81. And the growth, we didn't have the Oregon Health Plan then. We didn't have where we have so many of our citizens without insurance coverage in as we do. So the issues that this session is grappling with is probably, I think, a lot more complicated than, you know, when we were in this building in 81. That's not to say that your points aren't very well taken.
Well, I agree. You have a more complicated The Oregon Health Plan was probably the most innovative thing we did since the bottle bill. The state of Oregon, from the standpoint of a progressive move, the unfortunate part was the federal government never helped us out very much in trying to whittle down the amount of case, the numbers on the allowable use of that, which then stymied us on the ability to pay for that. So you have a very, very much more comp. You also have almost a million more people in the state of Oregon to worry about. I think that's where we got off maybe, or I saw the legislature maybe during the 90s, when probably some of these things should be have been looked at, and instead were quite content with raising user fees and things like that, didn't really look at the overall tax plan that time when we were really in a position to do so. It always seems we get in a crisis before we do anything. You're in that crisis right now, so I appreciate what you're going through.
I think that looking at it from a standpoint of the future, that all of us are faced with making certain that we put together a budget in such a way that you keep the structure, and so that we can rebuild in the future, and that we're not really being so draconian that we're devastating everything. I know in my committee, when you're having to make those kinds of choices, that the choices are that you try to maintain as much as possible within this environment a structure, whether we may not be able to totally assist everyone in the state, but certainly to where we're talking about something that we can build on when the economy turns around and we have a lot more dollars to deal with. But it's a lot different, Tony, than it was in 81. I can recall when I raised money for United Way in 81 you still had individuals. When you talk about fundraising, we raised the first million in Salem when I was the campaign chair. But the environment, as you're talking about, with the corporate world not having the same kind of resources, there's a total different climate in 2003 than there was in 1981.
And I'm reminded of the Chinese character that is the caricature for crisis is the same caricature as that for opportunity. And so we now have a crisis, but we also have an opportunity. And we need to explore those issues which may get us through the short term and those issues which will be necessary for the well-being of our budget long term. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Yes, sir, if I could just close and let you get about your very important work there. We'd like to thank you all for the time that you spend and for listening to our presentation. We very much understand the difficult choices that you have, and that many of you have very eloquently laid out. When I leave here, I have to go back and figure out whether we're going to cut 25 or 50 teachers from our school district. There are very tough choices out there, and we appreciate that. We, at the same time, believe that helping support the emergency alert system, the Amber Alert system, plays into that trade-off of potentially human lives, safety, the quality of life of the state. Our request is not that you reimburse us for all of the expenses there, but help that you can give us to help defray some of those very important costs that also potentially save lives. We appreciate any support that you can give us. We appreciate your time very much. We don't envy you the decisions you have to make, and we appreciate very much your willingness to address the issues that are in front of us.
I do want to say on behalf of the General Government Subcommittee, express my appreciation for OPB and the work that you do in the education process. I think that is absolutely invaluable. If we put a price tag on that and spread that around amongst the education community, that would demonstrate the tremendous commitment that you have to the communities and contributing towards education as well. Tom, I appreciate that and your dual role. Mayor?
Chairman Butler, I'd like to point out for Senator Winters that we have two programs in development that could be very interesting to you. One is a Department of Agriculture grant that we get to do programs on rural Oregon. We are producing one right now, which will be finished in June, on rural doctors. I'd love to send you a copy of that, and we're trying to find funds to do one on the nursing crisis, two major health concerns that we're we're kind of on top of it. And we are also in development with other people's money, we hope, a major health series, a local series on healthy aging and how to get people to take personal responsibility for their own health, which we think is a major issue.
Are you going to deal with the fat issue?
We should, because that's a function
it's the number one health issue.
Yeah, well, and it's a function of not having physical education in schools, and kids are ballooning. Mr. Chairman, sorry, I can talk about that.
May I introduce Mark Stanislavski, who's the manager of KSYS in Medford, who is a partner with us in terms of developing this whole statewide network. And would you mind indulging me in giving him a
go right ahead,
so
Mark.
Say a couple of words?
For the record?
I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Introduce yourself for the record, if you would, please, Mark.
I am Mark Stanislavski. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of Southern Oregon Public Television, which operates transmitters in Klamath Falls, which is the site of a successful Amber Alert apprehension, I might add, as also in the Rogue Valley in Medford. I want to express support for the principle of state funding for public broadcasting. I believe we are challenged to provide rural service. We believe we can successfully raise funds for the programs that we are able to provide through our traditional fundraising approach. In my own part of Oregon, we serve about 400,000 homes as the exclusive provider of public television service. We also have successfully partnered with OPB to extend our services and have several collaborative and cooperative relationships which actually help us provide the service in Southern Oregon. It's a very small region, very rural region that we support. Our fundraising ratios are higher than average. We would not be able to perhaps provide this service were it not for that collaboration. I think one of the issues, and there's really not much more I can add to what has already been said, that you're going to be grappling with public broadcasting is the ability to reach rural communities. That's going to be a very serious issue. And as we piggyback and use our technical infrastructure to deliver education, programming, culture, as well as services such as the Amber Alert and the Emergency Alert System, that's, I think, a worthy pursuit of state and federal funding to be able to provide access to all Oregonians.
Thank you, Mark. Representative Johnson.
Thank you very much for your testimony and calling attention to the fact that public radio and public television, in your case, are desirable in rural communities. I represent a rural community that has a public radio station that receives no public support at all. And a question that I'd like to ask Mr. Orm before he goes is that there was an issue with OPB's signal coming into my community and effectively blocking out our little local radio, community radio. And I know
that handled last session, Representative.
Well, I was very interested in an update on where we are.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, thanks. Thank you. What we did there was we were trying to replace a translator that had been bumped off the air because the FCC on 100-watt translators doesn't allow us to keep those permanently if another service comes in. So we were simply looking for another place to continue the service that we had already provided in that area. We were able to find one, and with KMUN, eventually we're actually swapped our translators because the translator number that we had was a better number for them. And as far as I know, made a very equitable solution to that problem. Mike Tondro, is there anything else you want to add to that? Yeah, so I think everything's fine, and we're all happy with the solution.
Great. Again, thank you for your dedication to
thank you very much.
Rural Oregon and particularly those agriculture issues. Eat more beef.
Yes, there you
that,
go.
We'll
thank
go
you.
Ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5535. Thank you very much. We'll adjourn until evening time tomorrow.